in the process of meditation. What we're trying to do is create a level of relaxation in the mind, a level of peacefulness and non-agitation in the mind, so that the mind is in a position to recognize and differentiate that which is changing from that which is changeless. When the mind is so busy and preoccupied with other things, with its worries or concerns, concerns of the day, hurts, feelings, etc., it's not in a disposition which can allow you or it to really focus on or be cognizant of that underlying substrate reality of your own being that supports, is present to, pervasive of all of these changing thoughts and emotions. So one of the first things we do is let the mind just simply relax. Give it some freedom to just think about the day or to reflect on whatever it chooses to reflect on. Just giving it some time to unwind. It's as though bringing the mind into a safe place where it's actually free to unwind, free from criticism, free from judgment, where it's just in the presence of a benign, caring friend. That attitude allows the mind to relax and unwind. It's as if you're in the presence of somebody who cares about you and loves you, who respects you, who is interested in you. In that environment, you can relax and unwind. This allows your mind and your body to simply relax and let go. Then, to let the mind relax even further and become more available for meditation, for just simply being with myself, I ask the mind, the different parts of my mind, different parts of the unconscious, is there anything that anyone wants to tell me, wants to say? Are there any concerns, anything bothering any part of me? And making yourself available to simply listen with interest and objectivity, to listen completely and fully, and then to offer any help or guidance. Once you've listened, when you've given the mind some time and some attention, enough attention, it will be relaxed enough to be available to discerning to rest in, to appreciate, the nature of my own presence. To be with my own presence, Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vaditamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. going to do the verses from the Hastamalakya Bhashyam. Shankara has written a bhashya on these 12 verses that were recited to him by Hastamalakya. I'll retell that story in a minute. And I will be referring to the bhashya, and I'll slowly make the bhashya available to those of you of some Sanskrit or want to have also the transliteration of the Sanskrit. I won't be doing the bhashya word for word, but I'll do some sections of it. But we will do every verse and then refer to the commentary. So right now I've just given you the first page that has the three introductory verses. Three prayer verses that introduce the Hastamalakya Bhashyam, supposedly written by Shankara. So I have my doubts, and I'm not sure. A lot of things that are attributed to him, some everybody agrees are by Shankara, and then some people will say, well, there's argument whether these things are by Shankara or a later Shankaracharya. It'd be interesting to ask Swamiji what he thinks about these particular verses, the commentary. You know, but in any case, it's an interesting commentary, and I'll be referring to it. So I've told the story of Hastamalaka before. I'll tell it again. Hastamalaka ended up being Shankara's youngest disciple. And Shankara came into contact with him one day when he and his other disciples were wandering through India, as they would do, stopping from town to town, village to village. Right there at one village, the parents of Hastamalaka brought him to meet Shankara and were extremely concerned about him because he never spoke. He was mute. And so they explained to Shankara, you know, our son never speaks and we don't know what to do. And so Shankara asked him a simple question, "Oh boy, who are you?" And Hastamalaka came out with these beautiful verses. And Shankara told the parents, "You better let him come with me." And so Hastamalaka then, from that point on, traveled with Shankara. So that's how the story goes. It's a beautiful story. So there's a young boy wrote these beautiful verses. So these three verses that you have here in front of you are an introduction to the bhashya and to Hastamalaka's verses, the introductory prayer verses, you can say. So, yasmin yate pavet sarvam, yasmin yate pavet sarvam, vignatam paramatmani, vignatam paramatmani, tam vande nitya vijnanam, tam vande nitya vijnanam. Anandam ajjam avyayam, anandam ajjam avyayam. Sandhi. Yasmin nyate bhavet sarvam vignatam parama atmani tam vande nitya vignanam anandam ajam avyayam. Yasmin nyate paramatmani. Yasmin nyate paramatmani. See, at the end of the sentence, paramatmani. It's all in the locative. Yasmin nyate. When who is known. When this Paramatma, the Supreme Self, Parama means that which is free from Desha Kala Vastu Paricheda, not limited by space, by time, by Vastu, by objectivity, so limitless. So the Paramatma is that self which is limitless. Sometimes in so many translations it's just translated as the Supreme Self. I translated it like that too, thinking, but I'll make up for it when I do the little commentary on what we mean by Paramatma. So, when the Paramatma, when that self which is limitless, is known, nyate, pavet, sarvam vignatam, sarvam, everything, vignatam is known. Pavet is emphasis. When the self is known, everything is known. Right? That's what it says. So, yasmin jnate bhavet sarvam vijnatam paramatmani. When the paramatma is known, everything is known. Sarvam vijnatam. Tam vande. My prostrations, my namaskara, my salutations, you know, to that paramatma. Tam means that, to him, to that paramatma. Tam vande. Who is nitya vijnanam. Nitya means free from time. Vijnanam, consciousness, awareness. Capital K, knowledge, pure knowledge. So, tam vande nitya vijnanam. That vijnanam, which is nitya, free from time. Ajam, free from birth, birthless, unborn. Avyayam, immutable, means does not decay. Does not go through any type of transition, does not change, immutable. Okay, so yasmin jnate bhavet sarvam vijnanam paramatmani tam vande nitya vijnanam anandam ajam avyayam. In the whole teaching methodology, which we talked a little bit about last week, initially in the teaching, in order to get to this Advaita, which is what it is, when you say, knowing this Paramatma, everything is known. You know the one thing, you know one thing, the Paramatma, and you know all things. That's what's being said, that's Advaita, right? So the examples, of course, are, if you know all of the different bangles, if you know the gold, you know all the gold bangles. That's the idea. If you know gold, you know all of the gold ornaments. If you know clay, you know all of the clay objects. Right? Because all of the objects are nothing but clay. Right? All of the ornaments, golden ornaments, are nothing but gold. So if you know the gold, you as well know all of the ornaments, because the ornaments are only gold. And that's the idea. That is the Advaita. So look at what that means in terms of us. In the whole teaching methodology, which it always starts with, not always, but the easiest route is starting with that see-or-seen differentiation, where I separate the subject from the object. That's the initial, what initially needs to be done. I have to discover what is non-objectifiable as an object. Now, just to understand that, think like this. As long as there is a subject-object relationship, there are two. So if I can objectify something, objectify means look at it, have it as an object which I'm aware of. Okay? As long as I can do that, there's Dvaita. So here in the world, our experience is only of Dvaita. Dvaita means duality. Duality doesn't... One time I was using this word duality, it can show you just how confusing words can be and how careful we all have to be. Duality was a word that was a real stumbling block from one student, because duality means two. And I experience many things, not two things, right? If when you say dual, you have to understand what dual means. Dual means more than one, subject-object. There's a subject-object relationship. So this manifest world of an infinite number of vastus, an infinite number of things, is what we call duality. Anything that exists within time and space, you know, where there's change, anything that's subject to change, anything that has form, that exists in the world of duality, which means where there is more than one. Advaita, it means not two. That's what Advaita means. It means one without a second. There are not two. Advaita means there's two or more. Okay, so everybody understand that for the Advaita? So now, Advaita, duality is there in any time I can objectify something. Right? So because there's subject-object relationship. And so, of course, as an individual within this creation, I am objectifying everything that I see through my sense organs and creating a subject-object relationship that I'm very aware of. I am different, then the subject is different from the object. So all along the way in this inquiry, until we, as far as we go, the subject is different from the object. Right? And so all we're doing, this is a fact in terms of my experience of the world, the subject is different from the object. This reality is going to continue throughout the entire Drisha Viveka, throughout the entire subject-object differentiation. The subject is different from the object, right? So it's a Viveka means discrimination. We're discriminating between these two things, the subject and the object. Easy here. But in the Drisha Viveka, that duality, that Dvaita continues because I can, as I go through that process, I realize, okay, the sense organs perceive the world, but they also objectify the body. So there's a dvaita, a duality between the sense organs and the world, and the sense organs and the body. Because the sense organs are aware of the body. But then I can say there's a dvaita, a duality. So the sense organs become the subject, and the body becomes the object. You see that? Because I'm aware of it. I'm objectifying it. That makes it an object. But now the sense organs become the subject. Because the sense organs are the ones that are aware of the body. You see the subject-object relationship there? And you see the dvaita? It's still there. Sense organs aware of the body. The sense organs themselves are objectified by the mind. Right? Because I'm aware of my eyes, whether they see, or my ears, whether they hear. I'm aware of my sense of taste or my sense of touch, whether that works. So that means that the sense organs themselves are subject to objectification. And now, again, there's dvaita, the mind, and the sense organs. Sense organs in the world. So dvaita, dvaita, dvaita. Now also, the mind is an object of awareness. Because it also is known, I can objectify the mind. Again, dvaita. Because here I am, the awareful being, and the mind, which I'm aware of. So yes, you are aware of your mind, because you can sit there and watch your thoughts, and you can tell me what you were just thinking, or you can tell me what emotion you're having. That means objectification. Right? So there's a subject-object relationship there. Dvaita, too. Subject-object. Now, we have the self. Now, we have to, is the self something that is objectifiable? The awareness that illumines the mind. Because that same awareness illumines the mind, also illumines the ahankara, the I notion, which is part of the mind. It's a thought. I am thinking. You know, if you say that the thought, I am meditating, right? That I am is a thought. I am sitting here listening. That I am, it's a thought. It's called the I notion. It's also objectified. I'm aware of it. I'm aware I'm having an I thought. Okay? I'm aware of the ahankara. Because I ask you, do you have an ahankara? Do you have an ego? Sure, I do. Okay. You're aware of it. So it's objectifiable. Subject, object. But now, your awareness, the you, the me, the one that illumines the mind, is it objectifiable? Is there a subject-object relationship that makes awareness an object? And what would that be? What would make awareness, the one that illumines the mind, and the mind illumines the sense organs illumine the body and the world, what illumines awareness to make it an object, to have that subject-object duality? What we say is nothing. That's what we say when you get to that bottom line of awareness. It's what we call svata siddham, self-evident, or svaprakasha, self-luminous. Awareness is its own experience. It's not known through objectification. It's known because it's self-evident as awareness. So it is its own light. Right? So from the standpoint of awareness illumining awareness, there's no subject-object. There's just non-dual awareness, except for the rest of the world. That's a big exception, of course. Right? But from the standpoint of awareness, there's not awareness of awareness. So there's no subject-object from the standpoint of awareness. Okay? So here, at this level of awareness, in relationship to awareness, there's Advaita, there's no subject-object relationship. So now we have the awareness which is self-evident and not requiring a subject-object relationship. And then we have the rest of the world. So we have awareness and the world. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say awareness in the world? Because anything that is objectifiable belongs to the world. That's why. If we say the world, by the world, by the jagat, by the vishwa, these are synonyms, the world, the jagat, the whole creation, everything that exists within time and space, everything that exists within duality, this whole creation that we perceive through our sense organs exists as the world. The sense organs are part of the world because they're also objectified, right? The mind is part of the world because it's also objectified. Anything that be is objectified exists within time and space, and so it belongs to the world. Right? I see it. If I objectify it, it exists within time and space, and so therefore it's part of the creation. Is that clear for everybody? But now look at this. The self is not objectified. And so it's not part of the creation. In a sense, it's not an object in the creation. It's not objectifiable. It's not that the self is not there, but it's not there as an objectifiable object within the creation. So that's why I say you have the self, the conscious being, and everything else. Everything else includes the body, the mind, the sense organs, the ahankara, the I thought, you know, time, space, everything. And so now that's why we're down to two, a non-objectifiable subject and this creation. Now, what this verse is saying, let's look at it again. My salutations, tam vande, I bow down to, I do namaskar, my prostrations, to that one who is nitya vijnanam. Okay? Nitya vijnanam means awareness, which is free from time. Now, just in this drisha viveka, we've arrived at that awareness, which has to be free from time because it's non-objectifiable. If you can't objectify it, it does not exist within time, the time-space continuum. There's no subject-object relationship there, so it's not an object within the creation that then is subject to time. And so that makes this consciousness, the awareness which has been differentiated from the mind and the sense organs and the body, nityam, timeless. So this conscious being that you are, which is non-objectifiable, must be, because of being non-objectifiable, it must be nityam, it must be free from time. And being free from time, I'll take anandam. I'll take ajam first, and then I'll get to anandam. I'll take ajam, the next one. Being free, because it's an easier order. Being free from time, let's look at it this way. The self is, awareness is, and it is non-objectifiable, and so therefore free from time. That means there is no past, present, or future. Can it be born? It already is, and it is free from time. So because it already is, it can't be born, because it's already there. And because it's already there, and it's free from time. It's ajam, it can't be born. It's also avyayam. Avyayam means navyeti. It can't change from what it is. That's what vyeti means too. You have something here, and this thing that is then modifies. That's vyeti. Avyayam means navyeti. It being here, it doesn't modify. It doesn't become something else. It doesn't change into something else. So this conscious being, this awareness that I am, is free from time, and therefore it is, and free from time, it hasn't been born, nor can it die, nor can it modify, because it's non-objectifiable, and so therefore not subject to past, present, or future. Now, this self, which is non-objectifiable, which is changeless, ajam and avyayam, this self is called anandam. If you look up ananda in the dictionary, it will say happiness, joy. Because we use the word ananda because the ananda from the standpoint of the self, if we were to just look at the word ananda from the standpoint of the self, that word that we would use would be anantam. The anantam means anta-an, without end, means limitless. I'll get to the ananda in a minute. Yourself, which is non-objectifiable, and so therefore, being non-objectifiable is not an object, right? What does it look like? How big is it? You can't objectify. It is, but it doesn't exist as an object within time or space, as an object within the creation. Is anything that can be objectified? How big is it? How small is it? What color is it? What texture is it? Does it have any borders? The instant you think of borders, you have form. If you border something, then it's within time and space, and there's something else next to it. And now you're within creation. You're objectifying. There's this self, and then there's this thing here. This is non-objectifiable. Okay? And so this self, which cannot be objectified as an object, but which is, what constricts it? Okay. If we say it is and nothing constricts it, then it is limitless. We're not ready to say that it is with nothing constricting it, because to say that, we can't have the universe hanging around. Because here's the self and here's the universe. And so we have the self on the side and the universe over here. The universe is somehow being something else there. It has got to constrict it. So it's going to be, the self is going to be butting up against that universe. And so we can't really appreciate anandam fully until we understand the nature of the universe. But for now, anandam means this self, which is non-objectifiable, right? Which is limitless, being limitless, right? That limitlessness is the experience of ananda. Or the experience of ananda is that limitlessness. So if we were to say, what do they mean by the experience of ananda? What is that? What does that word fall upon? What does that word label? Well, we would say it labels. It is a label of the limitlessness of the self. Not as an abstract concept, but as the very swarupa, the very nature of the self is limitless. And that limitlessness, that unboundedness, that non-dual nature of the self is the experience of ananda, swarupananda. And that ananda, we call it ananda, this anantam, which is unantam, without end. That's, that means unantam. Antam means end. That limitlessness reflects in the quiet mind as happiness or joy or fullness. But we don't say that that happiness, joy, or fullness that is the reflection of the limitlessness of the self and the mind. There's a difference there because the reflection in the mind changes. You can have tremendous joy or a little bit of happiness, pleasure. There's a whole different gradations of ananda that are that take place as reflections in the mind. But the source of that pleasure is the ananta, the limitlessness of one's being. When the mind steps out of the way by relaxation, then that subtle, quiet mind reflects the ananta and the limitlessness of the self as the experience of happiness or joy in the mind. So that's where this word ananda comes from. Ananta, from the standpoint of the self itself, the swarupa, the nature of the self. Ananda, from the standpoint of the mind, reflecting the ananda, the ananta, the limitlessness of the self. So I'll get to that maybe a little later. So for now, tam vande, I salute that timeless awareness, non-objectifiable awareness, which can't be born, it's not born, it's ajam, aborn, unborn, avyayam, navyeti, which does not modify from its current position, from what it is, won't modify, which is anandam, anantam, limitless. Now, yes, min, knowing that paramatma, that self, when that self is known, like nyate, yes, min, nyate, when that is known, everything is known. So, this is the step, right? You take the drictrish of it, you get to yourself, which is non-objectifiable, advaita, no subject-object. You get to that through the seer-seen differentiation. But then we have to go back to this world and say, what is the relationship of this world to me, to that paramatma? Paramatma, that atma which is free from desha kala vastu, the atma which is free from space, free from time, free from objectivity. What is the relationship of this vishwa, this jagat, sarvam? Sarvam means everything. It's a pronoun, sarvam. What is the relationship of everything? And everything is a word, good word for dvaita, right? Everything, because there's more than one. You don't say everything and mean one without a second. So what is the relationship of sarvam, of everything, to the paramatma? Knowing which, all of this is known. Well, the relationship is a non-relationship. Because knowing this, if by knowing this, the paramatma, all of this is known, this has to be this. This dvaita that I experience, what it means is this. This dvaita, this duality, which I am indeed experiencing, right? But that's why we have an Upanishad. That's why we need to be liberated. If we weren't, if we weren't experiencing this duality, which then makes us all subject to death, all subject to change, right? All different from Ishwara, all different from God. If we weren't experiencing this duality, we wouldn't need an Upanishad to make us understand what this is, what's going on here. So here we are experiencing this duality, which the Upanishad says, which is really the Tatparya, which means the essential vision. The Tatparya is the essential statement. What is the essential knowledge that's being given by every Upanishad and every Prakarana Granta of an Upanishad? Prakarana Granta means these texts like this Hastamalakiya Bhashyam, these texts which unfold the Upanishads. Right, what is the essential vision? The essential vision is that all of this is nothing but the Paramatma. It has none of this. All of these forms that we experience have no being apart from the self. Just like the pot has no being apart from the clay, right? Or the ocean waves have no being apart from the water. That the very substance, the essence, the content of all of these forms is nothing but the Paramatma. It's nothing but this consciousness, this awareful being that is non-objectifiable. It's nothing but the core of myself. See, I take myself to be a jiva here. This jiva upadhi. I take myself to be this body, mind, sense organs. This is what we call a conglomerate. So I take myself to be this conglomerate. And so in the Drik Drisha Viveka, I want to, in that seer seeing differentiation, I want to understand, all right, who am I really? Who is the indwelling, if I want to use these type of words, who is the indwelling self? Who is the ultimate subject? Who am I? Who am I actually? The one who is sitting here. What is the core being? What is the core being? How will I discover that? Right? How will I discover it? You have to go to that which cannot be dismissed, cannot be thrown off, cannot be I can't turn my back on it. I can't get away from it. I can't make it go away. I can't objectify it. Yeah. That's what is. That is the substance. The forms, or anything that I can objectify, I can get away from. I can jettison from my experience. If I can jettison something from my experience, that's not me. Right? Because I can be without it. To get to who you are, you have to get to that which you cannot be without. Now, this is interesting. That which you cannot be without experientially. Now, look at what this means. Right now, you are having an experience that includes the perception of this room, any physical sensations you may be having, the multi-processing that's going on in the mind and the brain, you know, different mood types and emotions, and your own presence. So if you were to just sit quietly, there's a multitude of perceptions, you know, of cognitions, of all varieties, including emotions, perceptions, fantasies, memories, and external perceptions to the sense organs. There's a whole variety of perceptions that are going on. And everybody will say, yes, that's true. And now if I were to use my language, just in simple language that we use in day-to-day, I would say, and these are all your perceptions. Right? They're your perceptions. That means that there's somebody here, a person, and me, for whom all of these perceptions are. And I can say, yes, I have all of these perceptions, and I remember some of them, and I forget some of them. I have what I remember, whatever's happening right now, and then, you know, I had some perceptions a minute ago, and other perceptions a minute ago, etc., like that. But all of these perceptions are coming and going in you. And we know that. We might say that in different ways, but I am the constant for whom all of the perceptions are. I am the constant for whom all of the emotions are. I am the constant one who has a healthy body or a sick body. I am the constant whose mind is happy or whose mind is agitated. So there's an I there. There's a me there. How to discover it? Well, I have to discover the one who is always there, present to whatever this changing phenomena is. I am the one that is always there. If I were to go, then who's here? Right? If, say, perception goes and I go, I'm gone. That doesn't happen. Perception goes, the emotion goes, the mood goes. All of these phenomena come and go. Everything, every experience comes and goes, except for me. You say, yes, that's got to be true. It does. It's just simple logic. Every experience comes and goes, except for me. How are we going to discover who that me is? By differentiating. And that's why, you know, in the meditation we did, one of the things we have to do, just relax the mind. Let it talk to it for a while. Give it, listen. Give it time. Create an environment for it to relax. Ask it, is there anything on your mind? And listen like a good parent, like a good friend. Listen so that that mind can settle down, so that it is free and available, not to become rigidly silent, but free and available to recognize me. Just simple, simple me. The me that is always, always present, no matter what the changing phenomena are. That simple me, that non-objectifiable me. I need to recognize that. And then I need to see this self, this conscious being that I am, this simple self that I am, what is its relationship to all of these objects that come and go? There's a ton of logics, but all of these objects that come and go do just that. Come into being, go out of being. Present themselves, they come and they go. They come and they go. Where do they come from? And where do they go? What is on either end of these appearances? Something comes and it goes. It wasn't there before. Now it's here. Now it goes. Do things which come into being and go out of being in the world have any being of their own? When we analyze it, what we say is no. If we bring in the good old clay pot, right? If you bring a pot into being, right? The pot wasn't there before, and you squash the pot, it's not there later. Right? And so the pot, this object, comes and goes. But the stuff of the pot doesn't. What the pot really is doesn't come and go. The clay doesn't come and go. What is actually there doesn't come and go. The pot comes and goes. The plate comes and goes. The tumbler comes and goes. But what is actually there doesn't come and go. Here, this universe comes and goes. Everything changes. It comes and goes. It comes and goes. It comes and goes. But what is actually there doesn't come and go. That which is actually there needs to be discovered now in reference to all of these objects that I experience that come and go. Because what is actually there can't come and go. It can't come and go, because if it comes and goes, it's not actually there. Like the pot, in reference to the clay, the pot, the clay can't be one of the things that comes and goes. Right? In terms of this illustration, the clay can't be one of the things that comes and goes. The clay is what is there. And then the nama rupa, the names and forms, can come and go because the clay is there. Take away the clay, the pot and the plate, etc., can't come and go. So here you take away what is actually here, And these names and forms of infinite, that you can break down infinitely, these infinite conglomerates that we give names to, can't come and go because there's nothing here. So what is the substance? The substance is that which can't come and go. That which can't come and go can't be objectified. There's only one thing that can't come and go. And the one thing that can't come and go is the being which is yourself. It's just that we think of me, this conscious awareness, only in terms of this body, mind, sense organs. When we think of me, we think of a person who looks like this. Rather than thinking of me, the one who doesn't come and go, which is the very being that all of this enjoys. If you have a dream, right? Every object in the dream, every single object in the dream, and the dream itself, enjoys your me. The entire dream enjoys one being. Everybody see that? If you have a dream, the entire being, the entire dream enjoys one me. The being, the consciousness of every single object, the whole dream itself, the Ishwara, the whole dream, and everyone in the dream enjoys one being. But of course, within the dream, every being says, I am, 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 I am. The rug is, the wall is. You are, you are, you are, I am. But in fact, in reality, the whole panorama of the dream enjoys only one me. The dream character needs to go through this strict Purusha Viveka to liberate the self, the me, from the body, mind, sense organs. And then has to give that body, mind, sense organs back to the dream. And then realize that that dream itself enjoys me, is not separate from me. That the dream itself comes and goes. It's ephemeral. It has no substance away from me. I, in fact, am its substance. I am the being which it enjoys. There isn't a second being there. So knowing my being, the Paramatma, I know all beings. Knowing my being, I know the being of all that is. Knowing the clay, I know all ornaments. Knowing myself, I know all of you. That's a nice way to say it. Knowing myself, I know all of you. Because I am you. Because there's only one me. So when that Paramatma is known, the self, which is non-objectifiable, which is nitya, which is timeless awareness, which is limitless ananda, which is not born and which does not change, which doesn't die, knowing this self, I know all of this. Because none of this can have any being apart from my being. Okay. So that's Shankara's first verse. Introducing. It's a beautiful, amazing verse. Very thorough. Sometimes the prayer verses, they do two or three different things. One is to give the vision in the verse, in kind of a capsule, to give the entire vision, and then also to bring to mind your teacher, you know, to give pranams to your teacher, and to give a reason also for writing the text. Gives pranams to your guru in the prayer verses. Giving pranams to your guru is to give prostrations to the whole sampradaya. You prostrate to your guru prostrates to his or her guru. It goes all the way back infinitely to prostrations to that whole sampradaya. So there should be always that prostrations there, which you will do. And then often there'll be a prayer that gives the whole knowledge and also gives prostrations to Ishwara, to Guru, Ishwara, and then the knowledge itself. So that's what Shankara is doing in his own way. Okay, let's take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Frustrations of life, and then I'm trying to figure out a way of, or is it an unrealistic expectation of the mind always being calm and resting in the self, and is that just something that comes with time and not getting so frustrated with life? And
you know, it does come with time, and it comes with clarity. That's clarity of knowledge. And clarity of knowledge means really, over time, integrating your understanding of the self with Ishwara. So it has to do with the recognition of yourself in the context of this world. In other words, here you are, a person, walking around in the world, relating to all of these other people and situations and all of the difficulties that are there, you know. And so your mind has to have your knowledge has to be able to be integrated into the context of your life. In other words, your day-to-day experiences, your knowledge has to be available for your day to understand your day-to-day experiences. And that's why so much teaching is necessary. You know, otherwise it's, you know, this is mithya, you're Brahman, go be happy. But there's so many situations. So you need to understand what the mind is, what the source of ananda is, what causes the mind to get upset, what's the karmas, you know, that cause you to be and to, for your life to unfold in the given way that it unfolds. Mm-hmm. There's so many details that just make a huge difference for the what we call the shanti, or just the peace of mind. You know, there's a lot of details to this knowledge that help for the day-to-day. Does that answer it, kind of?
Yeah, then the impatience comes in.
Yeah.
I'm just enjoying the peace. And then...
Well, you know, there's one famous little Shruti statement. I forget exactly where it comes from off that Swamiji, but the student goes to the teacher and says, you know, how long do I have to keep listening? Yeah. And the answer is, you know, you do shravanam until you don't need to. Mm-hmm. Again and again and again. Shravanam means understanding, and the manana is kind of pitting your mind, your doubts and your questions against that unfoldment, that understanding. The understanding of the Upanishads is the mananam. So that's the whole teaching, right? And then the shravan, the manana, is your questions. And the questions are necessary for your mind to get the depth of clarity that it needs, because the teacher unfolds something in a given way, but in your mind doesn't quite understand what she's saying. And what about this? But if that's true, then what about this? So until the mind works through every possibility that it has, that is bothering it, you know, it will be, you know, niggling in that area. So the mind starts relaxing the more it recognizes, not in a book learning way, but in terms of the reality of it, that the source of your experience of fullness or peace or ananda, the joy, the fullness or the wholeness that we seek in life, right, through getting a better job or getting a partner or whatever the hundreds of things are that we seek, in order, we all seek those things in order to become happy. Once you realize that the experience of happiness, of wholeness, has nothing to do with that, that the source of that happiness is one's own being, and you're never away from that being. When the mind knows that, it starts relaxing, because you don't really need to have this in order to be happy. Even though your mind may act like, oh, I really do need this to be happy, there's another part of you that knows, no, you really don't. And after a while, that part that knows, no, you really don't, becomes stronger than the one that says, no, I want this, I want this, I want this. It gets more of an attitude, well, if you get that, you can have it, fine, but if you don't get it, it doesn't make any difference. And it's much to the mind's advantage to know that. And so that knowledge becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, and the mind starts enjoying a certain level of relaxation because of knowing that. And as it relaxes, it's, what do you call, baseline happiness quotient increases. Just like for a samsari, if you're taking a walk through nature on a beautiful day, everything's perfect and your mind relaxes, your baseline happiness quotient is greater on that day because your mind is relaxed. It's not asking the world to be different. So as you recognize more that your being is the source of your experience of ananda, you have less need for the world to be in a particular way. That's what we call vairagya. You don't have the need. I don't have to have it like this in order to be happy. That vairagya knowledge, vairagya means that dispassion, not in a negative way. Dispassion is not a negative word. Vairagya is a very positive word. Sometimes when we think of dispassion, we think, no. But actually, it means that it's fine for me to have this, and it's fine for me not to have it also. And so, the more I understand that my experience of ananda, my experience of happiness, comes from the relaxation of my mind, not from the objects, then I become less dependent on the world being a certain way. And as that happens, it's kind of cyclical, everything builds on everything else, I can start having more objective appreciation of the world the way it is. And as I start increasing my understanding of Ishwara, if all of this is Bhagavan, is Ishwara, then I can start being more understanding of who Ishwara is, because this is Ishwara. And then I can get to know Ishwara rather than deciding how Ishwara is supposed to be. We all have ideas, you know, growing up in church and all. Ishwara is supposed to be like this, and I don't see that he's being like that. What's the matter with him? So we're able to kind of be interested in how it is. Not how it should or shouldn't be, but how it actually is. Because I'm not at stake. If I'm not at stake, I can learn and appreciate objectively what this creation is, what Ishwar is.
And sometimes I wonder if my mind ever relaxes as much as I just learn to accept that it doesn't relaxes, it doesn't relax, and I'm kind of, I get a certain amount of feeling of at ease by realizing that my mind just is, that's kind of the nature of the mind, is to run at all these different
things. Well, you know, why I say relax instead of, I use the word relax intentionally, because instead of become quiet. Because when we think of the mind becoming quiet, it means it's not
right.
supposed to think.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of it becoming relaxed, it can think, be relaxed thinking.
Right.
You can relax thinking. And you can relax thinking really quickly. You know, like when I was, once I was kind of learning how to run, and the whole, or do any type of training, any type of physical training, even in Pilates and all of those things, you have to learn how to do the training, whatever it is, relaxed. Say you're running at top speed. You have to be relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
The body has to be relaxed. So say your mind's thinking like crazy. It's just going. But it can be relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be tensely going. Can be happy that you have an active mind. an active mind that's not causing pain, what's wrong with that? If it's causing you pain, that's another thing. Say it's active in a negative way, always putting you down or putting somebody else down or complaining or whining or, you know, just having a heck of a time. That's causing pain. It's not the problem is not that it's active.
Mm-hmm.
And then his active mind is in a coma.
Yeah. And, yeah. But that's another thing, like when we do some of this guided meditation, it's not asking your mind, or not asking your mind to even become still. It can become still. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what's being asked. What's being asked is for it to become relaxed so that it can recognize what's going on with itself and with me. You know? Because otherwise we think, oh, in order to know myself or to recognize myself or to be with myself, my mind has to stop. And then we don't recognize that I'm always here, whether the mind is thinking or not thinking. It's not covering me in any way.
There's that analogy with, you know, the lake or whatever that has a lot of activity at the top, but at the bottom it's...
Oh, you mean pulling the reeds?
Still. Or just the water that's agitated at the top, but at the bottom it's still and quiet.
That's fine. Then with that analogy, you should realize that all things are happening at the same time.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that, say if you use the, it's a nice analogy, say we, I don't use it very often, but say we do, say we use a lake that has ripples on the top, and as you go deeper into the lake, it becomes still and has depth, deep, still. Well, you are the whole lake.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that the ripples are there, the stillness is there. The two don't contradict each other. And we don't tend to look at the analogy like that. We tend to look at the analogy as though I'm floating on the top here with the ripples, and I have to go down.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, no, you're already there, and you're up here. And both are there simultaneously. It's just that initially we want you to be able to kind of relax your mind and quieten your mind a bit so that you can realize that the simultaneity of that. After you know that, then it doesn't matter if your mind is thinking a mile a minute or it's not. It doesn't touch your being whatsoever. Not at all.
The non-analogy is the stillness itself, not another state of mind.
It's not another state of mind. the way I'm dealing with it at the moment.
It's great when you have a baby, you know. It's great training ground for that. Because you can hope, you know, to kind of get to the things you want to do. But they don't necessarily happen. And it might not be happening. I mean, the whole timing is completely thrown out the window. It's actually very beautiful.
Yeah.
It becomes like true satsang.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when,
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what it is for me.
I love that.
The modern day analogy.
No, but it's so true. And see, the thing is, I would imagine I don't have a child myself, but I've been with my sister's children. And, the love is so much for your child that you can really appreciate the truth of that. Because the love overrides the need to do your own thing. Mm-hmm. And so you can recognize all of that on a deeper level. It's amazing. Blessing. I remember once with my sister's little boy, when he was first born, he was just an infant. Maybe he was a couple months old. And I was at her house, and she had to go out, so I was babysitting. And I just had him on this little tiny guy, had him on my, just on my legs here, and he was holding my hands like this. And I was kind of rocking back and forth with him. And we must have done it for hours. I didn't get tired of it. It was just, you know.
I said the poop came out of the leg.
It was a different space. It was very beautiful. I'll never forget it. Oh, now he's 6'4". All these kids grown up.
You know, I've had this through teachings along the way, this idea, you know, that the idea of emptiness, the idea of nothingness, and, that's, you know, the self, you know, and it's a really frightening self to me, you know, that there would be nothing there. And when tonight, in various other points, I feel like you're really not saying that. It's just, you know, there's something there, and it's just, instead of nothingness, it's everything.
Yes, and also, I don't even think, depending, I don't know what schools you went to, but even with Buddhism, they'll use shunyata, which doesn't mean nothingness, it means emptiness. And often what is meant by, even if I were to use the term emptiness, it just would mean like this, the you. This me that is here right now, right, doesn't have parts. It's non-objectifiable. This body has parts. It's a conglomerate. It's made of many things. The self is not made of anything. The self is one without a second. So it's empty of things in terms of its own swarupa. So I'm empty of things. Doesn't mean that I'm not. So another thing on that is, the self that you are, as Brahman, as infinite, limitless, is the self that you take yourself to be right now. When you say, I am, you're talking about you. That is the self that's Brahman. There's not another self. There's not another self to recognize. It's just that this me that is so, I'm so attached to, that I love so much, I think belongs to this body. Right? And so then when this body dies, I will die. No. That's why we objectify the body. Well, if the mind, you know, goes, then I go. No. That's why we objectify the mind. So it's not as though you're going to find out that there's some self, you're going to discover some self that you don't know. You'll discover that the self that you do know, that you love, is just free from time. So there's no loss or emptiness. And then you think, well, what about when this body dies, I won't be perceiving this creation. I'll still be, but I won't be perceiving this creation. Well, for an Ajnani, in terms of reincarnation, you just keep this, the soul keeps taking body after body after body, and you do keep, experiencing this creation as a jiva. But when this body drops for a jiva mukta, then you're just Ishvara. You are the whole. You're the whole anyway. Right? Like the one who has the dream, the one who dreams, that one is the whole, whether they take a body in the dream or not. That's why if you have a dream, you have a body in the dream, you're looking at the dream from standpoint of that body through this body sense organs. If in the dream the body drops out and you're not identified with the body, then you're just, the dream is the whole. And either way is fine with you. It doesn't, because it's you. You are the whole. And then you take yourself as a body, you think you're the body, but actually you're not the body, you're the whole. And in fact, if the whole goes away when you wake up, then you're still the very being that was the self of the whole thing.
So it's the awareness that, and the awareness that, so right now there's this awareness that, you know, that you took us through the steps to where, you know, there's nothing, I mean, you can't objectify it. And then that awareness becomes, at some point, aware of different things. Like, right now I'm aware of only certain things, right?
It's the mind with the sense organs that are aware of certain things. The awareness is just consciousness. Consciousness with the mind.
Right.
Then your mind is different than my mind.
Right.
Right. And your mind will have different thoughts throughout the day from moment to moment to moment, so different experiences. The awareness is not changing. The awareness that the knowership, the subject object relationships belong to the mind and the sense organs, not to the awareness. That's why my awareness can be is your awareness, is the awareness of the rug, is the awareness of everything, because that knowership, subject object, is dependent upon the mind and the sense organs. But the mind and the sense organs are not away from your being.
Wait, that doesn't make sense. Because if you say the subject object depends on the sense organs, but
or the mind.
You but the self is the ultimate subject.
It's the ultimate subject.
Yeah.
But then when the ultimate subject, but
yeah.
That's why I say when we go through this, we end up with the ultimate subject that is itself not subject to subject object differentiation. Because you don't need awareness to illumine awareness.
Hmm.
Okay. But then now you're left with the subject, and now the one object in the form of the entire universe. So now you've got this subject object. Now, is this object, which is in the form of the universe, really an object? For there to be two, the awareness and the creation. We say no. Just like clay pot. You know, the pot, the form, or wave, the ocean waves and the water. Because this creation has no being. Next time we'll go to the rope snake, I think.
Something to look forward to.
Carol,
yeah.
Is there another distanta?
Drishtanta?
Drishtanta.
Yeah.
For either being a jiva and Ishwara or being all of Ishwara, is there a different drishtanta other than the one of having a body in the dream or not having a body in the dream?
I think the dream is the best one that we use for that, but we also use wave ocean. So the wave is the jiva,
mm-hmm.
and the ocean is Ishwara. The water is Brahman. That's one that's often used. But the dream drishtanta, you know, is really a good one for that. To show how the jiva is really part of Ishwara, and that the Ishwara, the whole, is not apart from the self. Yeah, those are the two.
In that dream example, can you define what the jiva, Ishvara, and
in the dream example?
Yeah.
Well, for instance, say, okay, you're having a dream, and say you've taken a body in the dream, so
mm-hmm.
you're a participant, you're a character in the dream. The character in the dream is the jiva.
Right.
The whole dream is Ishvara.
Okay.
And then the self is the self of the dream, is the self of the individual in the dream. The self of the individual in the dream is the self of the whole dream.
Okay.
Might be snoring.
Huh?
Might be snoring.
snoring.
But Carol, in terms of self-knowledge, you know, I mean, it's the mind of the jiva, that, even though it's not a subject object, but it's the mind of the jiva that recognizes itself.
Yes. In this way. It's not that the mind becomes a knower of the self, but the mind different. Let me put it this way. The self illumines the mind. And the mind says, "I am the self." Okay. So the mind and the self are in the same place. It's not like the self is here and the mind is over here with some gap in between. Right. So the self is totally pervasive, the very content of the mind. But the mind thinks that I am the conscious being and that the conscious being is the mind. That's what we call this mutual superimposition. Whereas in reality, the consciousness that the mind enjoys is independent of the mind. So the mind has to come to the recognition that it, the mind, is not it, that the consciousness that illumines the mind is not dependent on it. And that it, its thoughts, its feelings, its moods, emotions, do not change the consciousness. It needs to recognize that.
And one way it recognizes that consciousness is just that it recognizes that which never changes.
Yeah, it, the conscious being, that I am the conscious being that never changes. And it always does change. And it's known.
Right.
It's known, it and it changes. Right. But the consciousness, you know, is known as consciousness, but not as an object, and it doesn't change.
And it's also known as myself. I mean, then it becomes sort of obvious when you say I.
Yes. And I'm the one who's present to every changing thought. Okay. Yeah.
Can you say something about what's the difference between if Ananda is
Ananda? You know, Purna is another good word for Ananda, and Purna also means limitless, that which is completely full. Yeah. Purnamadav. That is Purnam. That is infinite. So it's a word, Purnam is a word that means fullness or infinite. It literally means to, it's a, literally, it, the word comes from pr, to fill. And it's a past, Purna is a past passive participle, which means is filled. So things like filled is full. Right? But we use it, the word purna, it's often translated as infinite. But yeah.
So the purnamidam.
Purnamidam, that is infinite. Purnamidam, this is infinite. From that infinite, this infinite comes. And into that infinite, this infinite goes. Om Shanti Shanti.
Carol, do you have any idea why it would be that I can't imagine something that's limitless? I mean, is it just because the mind can't do that? You know, it's kind of like the self, yeah, the self is changeless, and the self. And yet, you know, without borders. And so then I was thinking, well, is this because, you know, Dehatma Buddha, you can't sort of imagine yourself without borders? Or it's like really hard for me to imagine, like, no borders, you know, a creation without somehow.
Not a creation without borders. Well, that's infinite, yes. Spatially infinite.
Right.
Which is very hard to for us
too.
To. Yeah, yeah, that's probably impossible for us to recognize spatial infinity or time. Time bound eternality goes on forever. Mm-hmm. How can we can conceptualize it, but how can we have like a vision of it? I don't think so.
Or even
because of duality,
right.
Infinite duality, infinite space, infinite time, infinite objectivity. We can't imagine it. We can appreciate it, but can't imagine it. The self is not that like that.
Yeah.
For you to recognize what we mean by the timeless nature of the self, by the limitless nature of the self, you need to recognize the self. And then you have to ask, what does it mean, limitless? Are there any borders around me? You have to ask these questions. And then you can understand what it means, because yourself, your own presence, you can ask questions like, okay, does it have a right side and a left side, a top and a bottom? Do these words apply? Does it have a color? Is it blue or black or red? Do these words apply? Is it big or small? Do these words apply? You know? And you see, none of these words apply at all. You know? And then, is there anything else? Then, if you've understood the mityatva of all of this, then there's nothing else. And then you understand what it is. So you can't understand it away from it itself. What it is gives you the knowledge of it. Not a conceptual. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Pramana. Okay, I'm going to meet with somebody, so let's call it a night.
Thank you.